This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Donald Trump says top Defense Department leaders want to keep waging wars to keep defense contractors happy. We have more from AP correspondent Tim McGuire.
President Trump, during a White House news conference Monday, said ordinary troops like him, but not the Pentagon brass.
I'm not saying the military is in love with me. The soldiers are. The top people in the Pentagon probably aren't, because they want to do nothing but fight wars so that all of those wonderful companies that make the bombs and make the planes and make everything else stay happy.
The president slamming the military leaders as part of his continued defense against allegations that he made offensive comments about fallen service members, including calling World War I dead at a cemetery in France losers and suckers. The Atlantic first reported on the anonymously sourced allegations. AP and other media organizations verified those allegations with their own sources. Tim McGuire, Washington.
President Trump says that he is open to an investigation of Postmaster General Louis DeJoy after some of DeJoy's former employees said they felt pressured to donate to GOP candidates. And DeJoy is a major donor to Mr. Trump and other Republicans. Trump said that DeJoy should lose his job if campaign finance irregularities are uncovered. The Washington Post has reported that several of DeJoy's former employees felt pressure to make donations and that he would reimburse them. Such an arrangement would be illegal. In the state of Oregon's Capitol Monday, a right-wing crowd rushed a smaller group of Black Lives Matter counter-demonstrators, firing paint gun pellets at them. There were skirmishes, and the Black Lives Matter group dispersed shortly after local police arrived at the scene. Earlier Monday, hundreds of people gathered in a small town south of Portland for a pro-Trump vehicle rally. This is VOA News. China says that Indian forces crossed into territory it holds along their disputed border and fired warning shots at Chinese patrols in a move it called a serious military provocation. They have been engaged in a tense standoff in the cold desert Ladakh region since May. China's Western Military Command said the incursion occurred Monday along the southern coast of Pangong Lake. Chinese military demanded the Indian forces withdraw and investigate the move to open fire. There was no word of casualties. Late last month, India says its soldiers thwarted the Chinese military's moves to change the status quo in the same area. It was the site of their deadliest clash in decades in June. Health experts say that a coronavirus test that studies antibodies to see if people had developed immunity has failed to provide any concrete information. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn explains.
The White House and some of its health advisors had touted new antibody testing as a way to tell if people could get back to work and reclaim their lives if they knew they'd already had COVID-19 and were protected from getting it again. Well, those tests are available, but the Centers for Disease Control and the American Medical Association warned that antibody tests should not be used to make decisions about returning to work or school. Researchers say they still need proof that patients have future immunity, and that would come from experiments in animals, human trials, and measuring and tracking antibody levels over time. Research published last week suggested the protection could last at least 4 months. I'm Jackie Quinn.
More than 891,000 people have died globally from COVID-19. There are more than 27.2 million confirmed infections worldwide. The World Health Organization says countries that bolstered their healthcare systems in recent years have fared better than others amid the COVID-19 pandemic. And WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus praised Thailand, Mongolia, and Senegal for their response to the virus and urged all governments to learn from the current pandemic and prepare for the next one. The Australian Broadcasting Corporation says the last two journalists working for Australian media and China have come home after police demanded interviews with them. ABC says its reporter Bill Birtles and the Australian Financial Review's Michael Smith landed in Sydney after flying from Shanghai. Both had sheltered in Australian diplomatic compounds in recent days. ABC said Chinese police arrived at Birtles' doorstep last week, demanded he submit to questioning, and told him he was banned from leaving the country. More at VOAnews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Batty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Mali's M5 protest movement responds to ECOWAS's demands.
What would I tell the ECOWAS members is that you cannot discuss a political crisis without involving the players in the crisis and the movement who is trying to find solution to that crisis.
Anti-slavery activists are beaten in Mali. An opposition leader is boycotting Guinea's October election. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni wants to purchase biometric equipment for the 2021 election. And Ethiopian security agents stop journalists from going to observe Tigray election.
The federal government should not be restricting journalists, whether it's journalists working for international or Ethiopian media outlets, ability to freely report on these political developments.
And Libyan political talks in Morocco appear bumpy despite some measure of goodwill. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Member of Mali's M5-RFP protest movement says the group wants a return to civilian rule in Mali as quickly as possible. However, Dr. Ramata Sissoko Cisse, president of the Change in Mali movement, says the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, should hold direct talks with the M5-RFP because the crisis in Mali requires a political solution. ECOWAS leaders meeting Monday in Niamey, Niger, called for a one-year transition in Mali. They also gave the military junta until September 15 to name a transitional president and a prime minister. Dr. Cisse says the M5-RFP is also calling on ECOWAS to lift sanctions on Mali because the sanctions are hurting ordinary Malians.
We are following the ECOWAS meeting with a lot of attention because the sanctions against Mali are affecting millions of lives today. One of the things that we cannot do right now is send money through international money transfer system, which affects looking at the Malian economy. Most people in Mali live off of their relative outside of the country because at least 25% of Malians live outside of the country. So the ECOWAS sanctions are affecting really the country. As the responsible of the change movement in Mali, we know that we have to bear the responsibility for those sanctions. That's why we would like to recommend ECOWAS to lift those sanctions as soon as possible. At the same time, we understand the recommendation of the ECOWAS to transfer the power to the civilian people as soon as possible. We are negotiating to talk to the military so they can do that before the deadline, which is the September 15th, 2020.
The military junta there, I think it wants 18 months or so, maybe 2 years in power. How likely now that you think the junta with the M5 will be able to meet the ECOWAS demand for 1 year transition period?
There are a lot of recommendations that are made by ECOWAS that we agree on. We think that the M5-RFP, which is the political wing of the movement, should sit down again with the ECOWAS to discuss those conditions, because the problem is deeper than what they think. What the ECOWAS did, which is a talk between them and the junta, we believe that was a mistake, because we don't think that the military branch of the movement, we don't believe they could talk on political tables. It should be the political wing, the strategic committee of the M5-RFP. That's why we believe that those negotiations should continue so that we can truly determine how long the transition should be and who should be leading the transition. So the ECOWAS proposed 12 months and the M5 proposed 18 months, up to 2 years. And the military people are talking about proposing about 3 years. So there are so many discrepancies between these propositions that we need to sit down and talk if we wanted to really find solution to the problem.
If you were to speak to the ECOWAS heads of state, what would you tell them in terms of what's going on right now in Mali?
What would I tell the ECOWAS members is that you cannot discuss a political crisis and hoping to find solutions without involving the players in the crisis and the movement who is trying to find solution to that crisis. So I believe they need to sit down with the M5 RFP like they did before to come to an agreement so that it can be a solution that can solve the problem. We want to have a number of months that will allow Malians to sit down, to talk, to exchange, to tolerate, to discuss. So I just want them to understand we want solution. We want to make sure we understand, we respect ECOWAS. We are really thankful for them. But we want to make sure that they understand the discussion should be between M5 and ECOWAS, not the ECOWAS and the military junta, because military crisis cannot be solved with military solution. It has to be a political solution.
We do thank you very much again, as usual, for speaking with us.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Ramata Sissoko Cisse is president of the Change in Mali movement. She was speaking with us from Lawrenceville, Georgia, USA. Four anti-slavery activists were beaten to death in early September in Diadiome, Mali, because of their work fighting discrimination. Ousmane Diallo, a researcher with Amnesty International, tells Ricky Schreier the incident is just one example of increasing tensions and violence in the area due to efforts to dismantle a discriminatory system that denies rights to a slave class.
Of course, this is not in concordance with the constitution of Mali and with the national legislations of independent Mali. And it is in this context where you in those villages that are very far away from the capital and where traditional systems are still in place that this family was threatened with expropriation.
So the Malian judicial authorities intervened, and then what happened?
And they intervened and they said that the village chief and the conservative faction have no rights to expropriate those families or to force them to consider themselves as slaves. There is nothing obligating those communities from suffering discrimination and challenging the, what they attempted to do. And it is part of this social struggle that a mob went into the houses of those four militants in the village and beat them to death in front of their families on the night of the 1st to the 2nd of September.
What does it say about the state of the Malian government, the Malian authorities, and the ability they have to kind of protect the people of the country and make sure that justice is served?
I think this points out the fact that the Malian authorities can no longer be apathetic about what has been ongoing in the region of Kai, especially on issues linked to discrimination based on work and descent. They have to be more assertive in applying the national law protecting people from any violence linked to discrimination, especially based on descent, and also making a reality the Article 2 of the Malian Constitution, saying that all citizens are born free and equal in rights and in their duties. Because honestly, this is what it is about in Janjume and in several communities in the region of Kai, which have been grappling with violence linked to issues based on discrimination based on work and descent.
When people talk about anti-slavery activism and human slavery that's still going on in sub-Saharan Africa. Often people think of Mauritania. This unfortunate event sheds a light on the fact that over the border in Mali, it's also happening. Do you think part of that is also that this is often harder to speak about, people have told me, because it's black families with black slaves, and it's a very sensitive topic, and people often don't want to address it.
Exactly. It's a very sensitive topic with which people have been uncomfortable to delve any further, but you're absolutely right to point the links with Mauritania, because despite the fact that there are still lingering discrimination in Mauritania, we could see that among the Soninke communities, because it is the same community that straddles the two sides of the border between Mali and Mauritania. Mauritania has been faced with more international pressure to fight against slavery and discriminations against the Haritian community, for example, which made it easier for the Gambanahu Fede to make advance on that side of the border. But the situation is completely different on the Malian side of the border, because there is a lot of denial.
That was Ousmane Diallo, a researcher with Amnesty International. He was speaking to Ricky Strayak from Dakar, Senegal. In Guinea, the leader of the opposition Liberal Bloc Party has announced he is boycotting the country's October presidential election. Fayyami Limono says the same issues for which Guinea has not had its long-delayed parliamentary elections are still unresolved. He says the electoral register is still as bad as it was. Limono's decision to boycott the poll comes days after main opposition leader Selu Darlene Diallo said he would take part in the election. Limono says the National Front for the Defense of the Constitution has told Diallo and other opposition members who want to contest the election that to do so would be tantamount to betraying the memories of those killed by security forces during anti-constitutional referendum protests.
We have decided not to contest those elections because the same cause for which we haven't gone to elections for the parliaments are still the same. The registry is still as bad as it used to be. And what is new is the electoral body sent a clear letter to the Constitutional Court requesting to be authorized to violate the law to organize elections. And the Constitutional Court has granted that right to the Electoral Commission to violate the law. If you go to those elections, who you gonna go to complain to? We don't want to go to those elections because we don't want to contribute in having the text that Alpha Conde is calling today the Constitution.
As you know, one of your colleagues, Celine Darlene Diallo, has decided to take part in the election. Did he consult with the opposition?
Yeah, he consulted with the opposition, even though he knew that we couldn't agree with him by doing so. He's not the only one going to elections. Dr. Usman Kaba has done the same thing. And you have the lawyer Kabele Kamara, who also is a candidate in those elections. There are many other not well known who are going to those elections and who belong to FNDC. So we have stated clearly to each one of them, going to those elections is like we have betrayed the memory of all those who have been killed when we call upon them to demonstrate against Alpha Conde trying to do a coup d'etat.
I spoke last week with Guinean Information Minister Amara Sampare about President Alpha Conde accepting his party's nomination. I know the opposition has called this unconstitutional third term. Sampare says that the Guinea's new constitution created a new republic, which made it possible for President Conde to seek another term.
We knew that that would be what they will be telling to Guinean people today. And we have told people since 3 years that Alpha Conde is trying to change the constitution to seek a third term. And they were telling us, no, he has not spoken, he has not said, and so on. We knew from the day one that Alpha Conde wants to stay in power until he died. We are going to continue demonstrating. Now, more and more people have understood the danger to have Alpha Conde even for one more month.
We thank you very much again, Mr. Milimono, for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Fayyami Limono is the leader of the opposition Liberal Bloc Party of Guinea. He was speaking with us from the capital, Conakry. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Mbati in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 8th. Ethiopian security agents prevented journalists from flying to the northern Tigray region on Monday to document a regional election that the government has called unconstitutional. Officials also confiscated mobile phones, computers, passports, and press cards from the reporters. Simon Marks, a freelance journalist who often reports for VOA, was present at the scene and filed this story from Addis Ababa.
The regional vote scheduled for September 9 has rattled the government of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed as he attempts to transition the country into a new era of greater openness. The Tigray region, which led a multi-party government coalition for 27 years prior to Abiy coming to power, staunchly opposed the government's decision in March to postpone the national election because of the coronavirus. He has called any attempt to prevent its regional vote from going ahead a declaration of war. Ethiopia's upper house on Saturday called the Tigray election illegal, but stepped back from recommending any sanctions on the region for pressing forward with the election. Human rights and press freedom groups condemned the harassment of reporters by saying it was of utmost importance for international and domestic media outlets to cover events such as the Tigray election. Letitia Beda, Horn of Africa director at Human Rights Watch, spoke to VOA via a messaging app.
Events in the Tigray region are of immense public interest right now. The federal government should not be restricting journalists, whether it's journalists working for international or Ethiopian media outlets' ability to freely report on these political developments.
When approaching the gate to board a flight to Mekelle, journalists and several other passengers, including William Davison from the International Crisis Group, were asked by two security officials who they worked for, why they were traveling to Mekelle, and what the purpose of their travel was. Three local reporters working for Awolo Media, as well as this reporter, had their phones, passports, and press cards confiscated. One official also took down phone numbers from this reporter's phone and asked to scrutinize social media accounts. Two reporters from Awolo Media interviewed at the scene said they had been prevented from traveling specifically due to the election in Mekelle. Last week, the Ethiopian Broadcast Authority made calls to several journalists, warning them not to cover the vote on the grounds that it is not recognized by the federal government. A spokesperson for the Prime Minister's office declined to comment, and officials at the Foreign Affairs Ministry could not be immediately reached. The Ethiopian Foreign Correspondents Association said it was seriously concerned about attempts to prevent reporters from covering the election in Tigray. We urge Ethiopia's federal authorities not to underline the significant steps taken to increase media freedom over the past 2 years by attempting to police what journalists can or cannot report, the FCA said in a statement. Simon Marks for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni says his administration is in the process of purchasing a biometric equipment to help stop voting irregularities in next year's general election. The president also says it has been his mission since 1961 to stop vote rigging in Uganda. But opposition parties reject the president's statement, saying it is a publicity stunt. They have often accused the government of voter irregularities and, in some cases, rigging to ensure President Museveni and his governing party, the National Resistance Movement, NRM, remain in power. VOA's Peter Clottis spoke with Ugandan economist and political analyst Fred Muhumuza about the president's statement on holding credible elections.
I think an authentic system would begin with what is the register that we have, rather than looking at the tail end or the middle processes of the voting. So it's a good intention, but it's likely not to be to deliver the results that you would want to have, because the entire chain of registration of voters, validation of voters, the whole process of delivering the ballots on that same day, counting them, tallying them, and declaring the results, the satisfaction of the people meeting the minimum requirements of transparency and governance would need to be addressed, and that cannot just be done by the one intervention that is being proposed.
Fred, opposition politicians have been suspicious of the government and recent happenings at the Electoral Commission, where the president fired officials of the Electoral Commission. So do you think this will assuage their fears?
I think those sentiments and the questions will remain as long as we have said the whole process has a number of areas that are not clear and cannot be cleaned up in the current system. Even the firing of the electoral officials, I don't think will give the comfort to the individuals involved on the opposition side that is good enough, because the replacement may still be more or less people they will accuse of being friends or at least inclining towards Museveni's regime.
Talking about the strength of the electoral system, President Museveni says it has been his mission since 1961 to stop vote rigging in Uganda. Has he been successful in this mission?
I don't think so. It is very hard to stop it, but even when it doesn't happen, people will still have their own doubts, because there are many ways in which the credibility of the election is put to question by a number of people, including his own. One is, as we said, the voters register is not well handled, and also people do not have trust in the people who are in the first place compile and manage the voters register, the people you have referred to in the Electoral Commission. People always believe there is an inclination towards favoring the incumbent.
Bobi Wine, the popular musician and parliamentarian, otherwise known as Robert Kyagulanyi, has appealed for a level playing field ahead of next year's general election after he challenged President Museveni to a free and fair election. Is he justified by calling for a level playing field? And is there a level playing field when it comes to elections in Uganda and perhaps in the upcoming election?
Yeah, level playing field is very hard to achieve to the level that satisfies everybody, partly because of, as you say, different parties do not have the capacity. They are not well-resourced. A lot of people believe the ruling party uses national resources, given that the president's office and the machinery that is supposed to belong to the state, or at least resourced by the state, like resident district commissioners. And these are institutions of the state, institutions funded by the state, which are not available for the opposition party.
Ugandan economist and political analyst Fred Muhumuza was speaking with viewers Peter Clotte from the capital, Kampala. Morocco has been hosting the second and last day of what are being called non-binding political talks between a handful of leaders representing power centers from Libya's two rival governments. The talks appear to be focused on the number of posts that will make up a new governing council. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
As political talks wound down on the second and final day of negotiations in the town of Bouznika, Libya's two rival camps issued a statement saying that they were intent on reaching an agreement. Libya's Tobruk-based parliament spokesman Abdullah Bilhaq told journalists Monday that the objective of the talks is to decide how to apportion posts and not to select any names for those posts. Any agreement, he added, must be taken back to parliament for approval. Libya has had two rival governments since militias forced Prime Minister Abdullah Thani to flee Tripoli in 2014. He continues to govern eastern regions. A 2015 UN-sponsored political accord in the Moroccan town of Skhirat formed a new Tripoli-based government of national accord, which controls western parts of Libya. Moroccan Foreign Minister Nasser Bourita, who presided over this week's talks, tried to keep an upbeat tone during the meetings. He says the political initiatives from both Parliament Speaker Aguila Sala and the National Unity Government may push matters forward to a peaceful conclusion of the Libyan crisis. The Saudi-owned Ashark al-Awsat newspaper reported that the main objective of the talks was to reshape the ruling government structure and to bring down the number of leading figures in the country's ruling council from 9 to 3. Libyan Member of Parliament Ali Pakbel told the BBC Arabic service that it makes sense to bring the number of ruling council members down from 9 to 3, since the country has 3 main regions, but added that he opposes picking names from specific tribes or groups, since that is not how to run a modern country. Khatar Abu Diab, who teaches political science at the University of Paris, tells VOA that he thinks the military option in Libya appears to be losing steam amid a widespread stalemate, making the political option more attractive. Aya Burwaila, visiting lecturer at the Hellenic National Defense College, told VOA that the talks are a promising sign, but that many observers are worried about the independence of the High Council of State from Turkey. Tripoli-based Prime Minister Fayez Sarraj met with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Ankara on Sunday. Formal Libyan political talks are expected to get underway in Geneva on September 17th. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
And that's it for this Tuesday, September 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping that you will have a great day.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show. designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.
The Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 22:30 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.